It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. And in today's conversation, we'll be having one of those unique conversations, and it's about the idea that of health, nutrition, and our guest has a really great quote that her son said, "Mom, you're always sending on articles of food and health. Why don't you do something with that?" So her passion found expression. And when she accepted, different types of work along the way, including private lessons in her home and cooking. And I can't wait to get started with this conversation. And our guest is Joanne Irwin, who is a food for life instructor, I love this, plant-based Nana. Welcome, Joanne.
Hi, welcome. Good morning, Mark.
So let's just start. This is really great. So how long have you been, it's not preaching, but how long have you been encouraging family, others to get engaged in a healthier diet?
Well, for me, I have always been interested in health, going way, way back to like the 1970s when my first husband, deceased now, had high cholesterol. So I was reading everything I could about health and wellness. But, my background basically was teaching, counseling, nonprofit work with a prevention program, jack of all trades. But in 2006, I had gone to my physician on the Cape and, expected to bop in. And after having my labs taken the week before, I expected wonderful results. I worked out, I ate healthy, low fat, all of that. And my numbers were absolutely terrible. So 2006, I said to him, "Look, I will never take a statin." And he looked at me and he said, "Well, would you give up beef, pork, lamb, and dairy?" And I said, "Sure, I'll do it." And I went cold turkey that day. And as a matter of fact, if you remember Borders Books in Hyannis, yes. I went to the store, I sat down, I started reading and broke out in a cold sweat. I'm like, what is this thing called tempeh? And what is seitan? And what am I going to do? And my family is going to think I've really gone over the deep end. But in 4 months, after embracing that way of eating, my cholesterol drastically dropped into the normal range. It was 246. It went down to 179. But my LDLs, my bad cholesterol, were 179. That's not good. And they came down to 69. What did it for me? A few things did it for me. Number one, I had progressive arthritis in my wrist, which started in 2003. I was much younger then. And I really became alarmed. I had to brace my wrist for a period of time. I was working on a project typing and I couldn't. And I thought, how am I going to be able to pick up my grandchildren? How am I going to be able to garden? Well, in 4 months, eating this way, I was in the kitchen one day and I'm chopping and dicing. And all of a sudden, it's like there's no pain, no more pain. And, when I told my doctor, he said, "Well, when your external inflammation leaves, that means your internal inflammation around your organs is waning." So that did it for me. Not only did I see the changes in my labs on paper, but I felt a tangible physical change. And so I began reading. I became a student again. And I believe it was Da Vinci who had a saying about being a forever student. And I consider myself a forever student. So first of all, I read the work of Dr. T. Colin Campbell out of Cornell. And his famous book is called The China Study. He is considered to be the father of the plant-based movement. And he showed definitively over 20 years how dairy is carcinogenic, and it turns on tumors, and you take away the casein, which is animal protein, and you give it plant-based protein, and the tumors begin to shrink, begin to leave, disintegrate. You go ahead and you give the rats more casein again, and what happens? The tumors just thrive. So I read his work. I read the work of Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn out of the Cleveland Clinic, who did a major heart study. And a lot of doors opened for me. I had heard about Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine from somebody online who was an instructor. And when I shared my background and my passion, she said, oh, you have to apply, be an instructor. And I thought, well, you know, I'm not a nutritionist. Am I going to get on board? Well, you know, it's really amazing how the divine opens up doors if we just say yes. And I was down in Florida, 2008, and my doctor on the Cape called me. He said, well, I'm doing my first ever health fair at the Mattakese Middle School. It was Emerald Physicians then. Mm-hmm. They were the largest internal medical practice on the Cape. He says, would you come up and do the cooking demo? Well, of course, my friends down in Florida thought I was crazy to leave Florida to go up to Cape Cod in March, you know, to do cooking. But the keynote speaker was going to be Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn. And I said, oh, my God, I'm going. I will do this. And he gave a phenomenal presentation. And I followed him on stage and did a cooking demo. There were about 200 people. We had a blast. But his wife, Anne, was there, who's a prolific plant-based lecturer and cookbook writer. And I was telling her about PCRM, and she looked at me, she said, you have to be doing this. She said, we're on the board of Physicians Committee, and I'm sending a note right away to Dr. Neil Barnard about you. And that's what happened. She sent me the email that she emailed him, his response. And I went down to D.C. in 08, the day after Barack Obama was elected president, and went through certification, and have been learning and studying ever since.
You know, that's an amazing story. And when we think, or sometimes when I think in my generation, I think of plant-based, it's different now. But back when some of that first began, I remember things like the Moosewood Cookbook and things that were there. And they were fine. But, you know, most of the plant-based diet was, it was all ugly. And it didn't have much smell, and it tasted sandy and mushy, and we've come a long way.
You know, it's amazing, Mark. When I started in 2006, there was very little on the net about plant-based eating, and there was nothing on Cape Cod. I mean, I would go out to restaurants and ask them to make accommodations. But now, I mean, there's a plethora of information. I mean, there's tons of plant-based cooks and authors, and they have blogs. And I mean, and we're getting saturated on the Cape, which is phenomenal. And the movement is happening. And, you know, it's not only for health and wellness. I mean, it has been scientifically shown to make dramatic results in really reversing heart disease, in putting cancers into remission, if not complete remission. Reversing type 2 diabetes. I mean, everything we teach at PCRM is solid scientific information. It's not a fad diet, not pie in the sky like Atkins or keto, whatever. But so it's a paradigm shift. And like all of these shifts, and you go back to all of the great movements of my time anyway, civil rights, feminism, whatever, those shifts take time, but they're happening. Now you go to a grocery store and there's just a wonderful selection of plant-based items. But you have to read the labels because many of them are very high in fat. And that's one thing we teach in our classes. Learn how to read a label. Learn how to figure out quickly the percentage of calories from fat. So things have changed, and it's wonderful.
Yeah, and it is wonderful. And I love that you teach classes about it, because one of the things still, and you hit it, when I go to the grocery, it's easy to find plant things to make something out of. And plants, you know, farmers markets and all that. But the thing that I struggle with sometimes is not having the recipe to make that flavorful or make it tasty. And I think there was a movement for a while, which I'm glad we've sort of dropped, which is to make it look like it was chicken or like something else. And it can. However, I don't think that's the point. The point is that in and of itself, it does not have to be looking, tasting, smelling like a meat. It It is delicious on its own.
It is.
And that's what you're doing. And you're right. The food in the groceries, often you have to be really careful because a lot of that is so processed. It's worse than what the alternative would have been.
Yeah. So
you do have to read those labels. You do have to know how much is the fat content, how much is even the sugar content on some of those. And so you do have to be careful. When you teach your classes, so I think you said that you're home based on doing it. So how does this go about? How do you teach these classes?
Well, when I even before I was accepted at PCRM in 2007, a reporter heard about me. I don't even know how. She contacted me and wrote an article in the Register then. We no longer have the Register local paper. And she said, why don't you offer a class? Which I did. I offered a private class, and that was my first class I did in 2007. And then my doctor, Dr. Siddhartha, who's now with Cape Cod Healthcare, he had me do classes for then Emerald Physicians and also do classes at a library. And then when I went with PCRM, I do them in various venues. I went back and forth to Florida for 20 years. And the reason I went down to Florida under great duress, it's not my favorite state, but went down to Florida because I connected with a wonderful nonprofit called Cancer Alliance of Naples. And they are a wonderful group that provides financial services for families going through cancer treatment who are financially stressed. And so they, after about a year and a half, they found grant money to sponsor my classes. So the classes were free for all those years to people. And I would have 35, 40 people in a class. And a lot of work, because it involves bringing all the cooking equipment and doing the demo. So right. There's a combination, you know, education, cooking, and then they get to enjoy a meal. Important for people to taste these foods, to know right. that they're, you know, more than twigs and nuts.
Yeah. And it is the dining experience. And that's what you're talking about on the change, that it's not a diet. It's a change in, you know, in how we approach it. Yeah. But we don't have to lose beauty in the food, color, you know, taste, smell. All those can be fantastic. And we don't have to, you know, unfortunately, my mom, like many, had to live part of her life in a nursing home. And it was the food. I would never eat that food because it was all browns and yellows.
Yeah.
You know, and they didn't do anything to make it where that would be of any kind of taste. You know, everything was overcooked in terms of the vegetables, you know, to where they weren't green anymore. No. So it was just, you know, it was sad because we can do better than that. And we can do better institutionally than that. And, you know, so I think about a lot of places, even when I go to restaurants still today, it is sometimes hard to eat well, because most people still want things that are on the sides or whatever. The way they combine a meal sometimes is really tough. So I do find that it is difficult sometimes, even in a restaurant, to find something that I can pull together that will actually work. Not the one offering, you know, they usually have one and it's usually like a salad with something, but you know, I'd like to have something really that's a chef really worked on.
Well, what we're doing on the Cape, I mean, to change that back in 2015, well, let me go back in 2012, after I started doing classes, I found a group called the Green Nosh Group of Cape Cod because we're green and we're noshers. And the reason for that was to really give support to people who wanted to embrace this lifestyle. And it is a lifestyle. It's not a diet. It's a lifestyle. Right. And so we started having monthly meetings. We'd bring in guest speakers. I would show movies, DVDs like Forks Over Knives, Cowspiracy, a lot of those wonderful documentaries that have come out. And then in 2015, myself and one of my helpers, my partner in crime in this, we decided, let's try to get restaurants on board on the Cape. And so we had the first ever plant-based chef challenge on Cape Cod in 2015. And we had 15 restaurants that committed to this. We had a whole team working on it. We had boxes at each restaurant. We had voting slips, which at the time, Emerald Physicians paid for copying all of our material. And the whole goal was for the month of October in 2000, each restaurant was to have on its menu a healthy plant-based option. And it was a lot of work, a lot of fun. And at that time, I showed the movie Plant Pure Nation, which was put out by Nelson Campbell, the son of Dr. Colin Campbell, Nelson and his wife, Kim. And so it was a lot of fun and a great success. Unfortunately, at the time, a lot of restaurants did not keep some of those wonderful entrees on their menu. But now there's such a resurgence. We have some restaurants on the Cape that are plant-based. There's Fair and Just in Brewster, which is totally plant-based. There's Bread and Roses in Hyannis, which is a cafe bookstore, which is totally plant-based. So there are options. And, you know, I encourage, and then also I find a lot of restaurants are including different options for breakfast. They're including bowls like quinoa bowls with asparagus and veggies, et cetera. And, you know, people ask, well, what do you do when you go out for breakfast? And often I'll say, well, look, I want what I call a potato omelet, no eggs. Give me a big mound of your potatoes and put as many veggies on the top that you do when you do a veggie omelet. And it's delicious and it's nutritious. And you have that feeling like I'm going out and eating. I'm treating myself today, you know? So things are spreading on the Cape.
Yeah, and you don't get what I find anywhere, you know, anywhere that I am, in the restaurants in Indianapolis, for instance, that it's more common now without somebody going, you know, big sigh, like if you ask for something, it's much more common for restaurants to be willing to allow you to tweak things a bit.
Yes.
You know, some really the frustrating things sometimes are the really high end restaurants where it's like a celebrity chef and they don't want to change anything because that's the way it is. But those are frustrating. And I don't go that often anyway. But I do find that when I go to my regular restaurant, they are more than happy to accommodate whatever it is. And I think we've come to that because we've learned things about food in general. The other thing that I wanted to talk about briefly with you is, so there is this idea among people, and it's not just among plant-based, but in general, that spicy is a bad thing, that it means it's hot, it burns your mouth. And I think we've got to turn the tide on that having spice in food doesn't have to mean that it's going to bother your digestive system or you're not going to burn your mouth. And so do you have some tips about how we can rethink about spices when we do plant-based cooking?
Well, I mean, number one, so many spices are loaded with antioxidants that benefit our cells. And, you know, many of them like turmeric have been found to be cancer fighters and cumin. And, you know, these spices are not like hot, hot, hot. Like you might think of a jalapeno, like, oh, I can't eat it. You know, I'm going to be on fire. But they flavor food. You know, they really partner with food so well to make it so appetizing. Ginger, when you take a look at ginger and garlic, I mean, the allium vegetables, your onions and your garlic are absolutely loaded with cancer fighting properties. And, you know, moving aside from the spices for a minute, mushrooms, people don't realize mushrooms are such incredible cancer fighters. There was a study done in Shanghai showing that breast cancer survivors who had at least one mushroom a day, one button mushroom could be, reduce their risk of recurrence by like 82% in premenopausal women, something like, and postmenopausal, and premenopausal even more, like 87%. So these foods, and I tell class participants, you go to the store and you see the kale and the collards, and you want to go and you want to hug them. What they do for us, what science has shown what these foods do with their phytochemicals and antioxidants are incredible. So spices partner with that as well. I mean, I use tons of spices, ginger, cardamom, turmeric, all of the Indian spices, the garam masala, all of that just give foods a phenomenal flavor. So, you know, they're not loaded, foods aren't loaded with a lot of oil. I have to say that's a big thing. A lot of people, especially with type 2 cancer patients, they focus on sugar, sugar, sugar. It's not the sugar, it's the oil, it's the fats. It's the fat with type 2 diabetes. And people are just amazed at the science and the research that's done around that.
Yeah, I you know, that's really important. It is important, the type of sugar we have. It's important, the type of carbohydrates. All those are, we know from science, and that's what you're saying. But, you know, you mentioned one of the things that I still can't get, I have not had a good meal of, and I'd love to have it, and that is kale. I still cannot get around the bitterness of that. And I like Brussels sprouts, and I've found ways to do that. But a lot of times, I think it's because I had early bad experiences with kale where somebody really just eat this kale, you know, because it was supposed to be good and they didn't even put a good vinaigrette on it or anything. It was really awful. And but again, you're talking about that. How do I change my past experiences with foods that I might not think that I could eat or that I might not like? So that's part of what you're talking about too, is how do I come to approach it differently, right?
Yeah, what I tell people in my classes, number one, is to be gentle with yourself. And if you want to learn about these foods and begin to embrace them, take it slowly. And I often suggest take 1 week, your first week, and make every breakfast plant-based breakfast. And there are so many different options you can do. So work on that. Do your research. That's important. Don't just listen to me or believe what I'm saying. Go do your own research to make it your own. And then the second week, bring in lunches. Lunches, you can do soups, you can do wraps, you can do great big salad bowls. There are so many different choices that you can have for lunch. And then the third week, bring in every meal at dinner, a plant-based option, and start off with like the food you like. So if you love your pasta and your spaghetti, instead of having, you know, pasta with Alfredo sauce or a lot of meat, have a marinara sauce. Chop up some greens and throw it in your sauce. Instead of like, you know, the burritos that are loaded with fat and meat, have a bean burrito, which is wonderful. I made a couple of burritos the other night Bill and I each had three. They were delicious with beans and veggies and a nice enchilada sauce. There are so many things that people can do, like shepherd's pie, for instance. People love shepherd's pie. You don't have to put meat in your shepherd's pie. You can use tempeh, which is a wonderful soy product. It's fermented. It's not processed a lot. It's very healthy, low in fat. Or use mushrooms or put veggies in it. So you use the same spices and you can do a lot of what you're used to doing, but make some tweaks, you know, but start slowly. And then begin to find a couple of cookbooks that you really enjoy working with and try some new recipes and rate them. What did you like? What didn't you like? What did you add? What would you take out? So, you know, sometimes people in my class say, oh, just give me the recipe. You do the work. No, 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 no. You want to make it your own. You have to do the work. I can share the information. I can tell you the science, but you have to do your work and you have to read it yourself to become a believer.
Yeah, and it is working yourself along that path, but being patient with yourself, right?
Yes.
You're not going to just cold turkey it, usually. And excuse me. So you're going to be able to get there, but be easier on that. And again, it's a journey. I think we're so programmed to be diet.
Yeah.
And all the scientific studies on diets are really bad in terms of once you stop it.
Yeah.
Tendency, because we have not changed fundamentally what we've been doing.
Yeah.
Once you stop it, almost everybody goes back to the problems they had before the diet.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other key thing too for people is to understand how certain foods act on our brain like drugs. You know, the addictive foods, cheese is very addictive. Chocolate is very addictive. Meat is addictive. And, you know, people who eat cheese, and it's true, let's face it, you go to a party and you might say, or in the past, oh, I'm just going to have like one little piece of Jarlsberg. And before you know it, you've eaten half the platter because cheese acts on the brain right away. Cheese is laced with something called a casomorphine, and that acts on the brain just like an opioid would. So there are some foods that are addictive.
Yeah, it's also an umami. So it makes you want to eat it too. Mm-hmm. Because it's flavorful and flavor enhancing. So if you have it like with a piece of salami, you know, that somebody would have, you know, together, what you've done is you've just created this perfect little world for your mouth and senses to go crazy. You're exactly right. And you can't stop.
No, it's true. The same with potato chips.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and I tell people, look, I'm human. We have our big family gatherings at Christmas or birthdays, okay? And my daughter, who's a potato chip lover, puts out a big bowl of potato chips, and I'll say, oh, I'm just going to have one. Well, before long, we've had a little more than one. It's loaded with acrylamide. It's addictive. So but to be easy on ourselves, too. You know, people in my class will say, oh, gosh, you know, I kind of went back and I did this. So what? You know, be easy on yourself. We have to learn how to be gentle with ourselves so we can be gentle with others. You know, don't chastise yourself if you go out and have a piece of meat or whatever, you know.
Yeah, I want to return to one thing you said earlier in your own journey. And that really, I think, is intriguing. The idea that you can be doing all the right things. You know, you're exercising, all the things they say, you're not overweight, you're exercising, you can be relatively fit, you can feel good. And then you go to the doctor and all of a sudden the numbers are there. And so really, really people who sometimes think they're really healthy may not be. So this talks about that relationship. You still need the science to give you the numbers to say what it is, but then you need the science of what you do, which is in the nutrition side. You can change this, and it doesn't always have to be, maybe initially it has to be a pill until you get there, but it doesn't always have to be the solution as a lifelong pill. You can make these changes.
Agree, very much so. The other thing I have to add, and I tell people too, most recently, I became certified as a health coach in the Radical Remission, Radical Hope Project. I have always, always been interested in cancer, always, since my father was diagnosed and my first husband was diagnosed with a very, very rare cancer back in 1987, which diagnosed one out of 500,000 people. And so when my father was diagnosed in 84 with colon cancer, I started reading everything I could about the mind-body-spirit connect and read the work of Dr. Carl Simonton, who was the father of psychoneuroimmunology. And again, doors opened. We were in Tulsa at the time, and I knew he had a center in Dallas for people who were dealing with cancer and other chronic illnesses to go and to learn about, you know, meditation and positive thinking and your attitude, et cetera. So I picked up the phone, made a call, and the person who answered was, his name was Bill Irvin. Bill Irvin was the psychologist who worked at the center with Carl Simonton, and his center had at that time moved to California. Long story short, when I told him my journey with my husband, et cetera, this new diagnosis, he said, you know, I have friends in Tulsa. I'll be willing to fly up, see them, and spend a weekend with you and give you over the course of a weekend what you'd get if you went to the center in California. I was like, oh my God, you want to talk about divine intervention? And we spent a weekend with him, and I still have everything on tape. And about 6 years ago, I read the work of Dr. Kelly Turner out of Harvard and UC Berkeley, who studied people who had radical remissions. You know, what is radical remission? You have, excuse me, traditional treatment doesn't work. You have combinations of both. And you go into remission. You beat the odds. And, excuse me, water. She has interviewed over 1,500 people who've had radical remissions and found 10 factors common to all of them. And one of them is nutrition, but the rest have to do with the mind-body-spirit connect.
Yeah, and we're finding, we really are finding much more. We almost threw everything out with that when modern medicine came along and pharmaceuticals. And then we're finding that we can back into some of that, and that it's the combination of the two. You don't actually throw one out, and they can work together very well. I've been talking with our guest, Joanne Irwin, about the ways plant-based diets can lead to a healthier lifestyle. Please join us for more conversation after a short break.
Hi, this is Toni Morris. Join me for an hour of some of the best music for guitar on Classical Guitar Alive. Each week, we explore a wide variety of music with guitar, and you'll also hear interviews with many of the world's foremost performers and composers. That's each week on Classical Guitar Alive.
Saturday mornings at 5 on WICR, The Diamond.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today I'm having a conversation with our guest, Joanne Irwin, about her food journey, our private cooking classes. And when we left, you just started to mention your work in relation to nutrition and plant-based diets and cancer. And I think most of our listeners would find this to be really interesting. So I know you had personal experiences where your father and then your first husband with that, and those are really difficult. But you seem to have figured out a way to make some sense of how we might not always have to be having that be our result.
And even if we have that result, there are ways to really affect ourselves, our DNA, by our thoughts, by dealing with negative emotions, by embracing positive emotions, by being your own advocate when it comes to dealing with your medical team, by engaging with positive social support, so important, and having some type of a spiritual practice. And it doesn't always just mean church. It can be church, but I'm talking about it can be yoga, it can be meditation, it can be walking in a forest and doing some tree bathing, and also movement, exercise and movement. The work of Dr. Kelly Turner is absolutely astounding. And, you know, the thing with my first husband, with his cancer, which was exceedingly rare, the year that he was dying, my sister-in-law, his sister was diagnosed with the same cancer. Long story short, because of that, the family was entered into a study at the NIH. There's one doctor in our country who's dealing with this carcinoid syndrome, doing research on it, trying to isolate the gene. My sister-in-law, who died, had three children, my two nieces and nephew. My niece died from the disease in 2016. My nephew was found to be operated on for it. They found it at the NIH, and he's okay. My late husband's brother was diagnosed with it. So it is one of these very rare genetically linked cancers. And both my kids go down to the NIH every 5 years for massive testing. And thank God they've been clear. So, you know, sometimes you're never a prophet in your own homeland. I gave up preaching when I first found this for myself in 2006. I wanted to tell everybody, and I thought, oh my God, look at the results. Everybody's going to want this, you know, my family, whatever. But again, you're never a prophet in your own homeland. And, you know, I've said to my kids, you can have the gene for this, but it doesn't have to be turned on. And the whole new field of epigenetics shows how those genes can be turned on. And stress plays a big role, you know, and I know that from my own life as well, too. So that's a tremendous interest of mine. And yet again, in the final analysis, everyone has choices. People choose what they want to do for themselves and their health.
Yeah. And what you were saying, and science is really, really progressing in this area. And that's that whole idea of your genes are there. So you can, a lot of us can possess negative genes or other ones, but they may never, the point here is they may never express themselves. So you might, that's where, you know, using only the genome to determine what our future is may or may not be there, because it's also our environment that's affecting it. And that's what you're talking about with the epigenetics. It is the expression, the turning on of those.
Right.
And we know that about a lot of cancers, and I've known that for a long time, that you sometimes you have to have two things that go together. Mm-hmm. You have to have the genetic. I remember a young child that I knew that died of bone cancer. Right. And it was, you know, he had genetic profile there to have the bone cancer. it wasn't until he got a break in the inflammation at a certain point in the cancer that was enough trigger to express the gene for him. And, you know, we're just learning that that is there. And we're learning that if we can keep it from being expressed, which is part of what you're talking about, then we can do that. I like also what you just said. When you're talking about it, it isn't that maybe it prolongs our life, or it may not be that it even just keeps that from happening completely. But that may be inevitable for some of us. However, you're talking about a quality of life during that, right? And so you're talking about things that would make us feel better.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that makes such a difference. And again, people have choices as to their treatments and what they want. And, you know, there are so many avenues where people can have a quality of life. And I have to say, even science has now come up with you know, different types of pharmaceuticals, too, that can extend life as well, too. So pair that with what we know about the whole mind-body-spirit connection can really help people to continue to live fully and to enjoy their friends and their family. I mean, we're all going to die. I mean, we're not going to escape it. And quite frankly, one of our top nutritionists for years at PCRM, a year and a half ago, she was a marathon runner, young mom, beautiful, beautiful girl, healthy, vibrant, died of cancer. And when the news came out, everyone was shocked. How did that happen? She eats plants. This is not supposed to happen. We do not know what is in someone's life, what stresses, what toxins, whatever they could have been exposed to, which cause a disruption in our genes, which cause that mutations. And, you know, not to think that because you're eating this way, you're going to live forever. I have my grandson who keeps saying, oh, Nana, you're going to live to be 90. I said, don't say that. I almost killed myself almost 4 years ago. And, you know, was rushed to trauma with a brain bleed and a spinal bleed. And, you know, the doctor had said to me, and in therapy at Spalding, if you were not eating the way you were eating and working out, your recovery would have been so much longer. So this way of eating can also help too when traumas happen, you know?
Right. Things that can be totally out of your control. You know, you can be
exactly.
I was hit years ago on my bicycle by a car, and it, you know, it was because I had been exercising regularly. My muscles were stronger, you know, because I did upper body exercises, which bicyclists don't sometimes do.
Right.
And those all made my body more resilient from the hit. And so, as well as wearing a helmet, which is another thing.
The part of it.
But I would, what I also love about what you're saying and is that we're talking really about not longevity as much. That may, it may be that we affect that, but it is, we're talking about, again, back to what I said with the cancer, quality.
Oh, yeah.
So we might get sick, but maybe not as often, or we might get sick and bounce back faster, or we might have a trauma and bounce back quicker. It's about building a resilient body, which we're learning for our environment, right? That we need to build a resilient environment too.
Oh, yeah.
And your body though needs to be, the old thought was, and the old thought of medicine more was you built resistant bodies, but that's a losing some game. You can't make a body resistant to things that are going to just happen, but you can make it resilient to be able to react in ways that are able to adapt to that.
You know, absolutely. And, you know, given what we went through with COVID and the pandemic, two major studies came out, one out of Harvard and one out of England, have shown that folks who were eating plant-based lifestyle who came down with COVID did not have a need for hospitalization or these very, very serious, side effects, ventilator, whatever, that they were able to kind of manage the disease much better than people who went into COVID with a lot of comorbidity conditions, obesity, being overweight, heart conditions, etc. And I came down with COVID in January, quite surprisingly, and, you know, really kind of sailed through it. Didn't need Paxlovid, wouldn't take it. Matter of fact, I even had a physician say to me, I don't want you to take it. We don't know enough about it. Okay. So I didn't. But When you read about how so many people went into COVID with so many conditions of being terribly overweight, having obesity, and succumbing to the disease when maybe they didn't have to, you know,
I agree with you.
Tough to watch.
You do have to. And there were so many people that went in there also that would say things like, well, I'm healthy. I don't have the comorbidities. And I would say to them, you know, you don't know. You know, it's like you went to the doctor and there was this, or you have a gene that maybe we know about long COVID that for some people, it turns on a response, the inflammatory thing creates some other long-term problems. So we just don't know. We think we can be healthy, but we're just going to sail through something, and that doesn't mean we can. But it's again back to what you're saying, building a resilient body system is allowing. One thing too, I think that I get concerned sometimes about is lots of times there are individuals who throw everything out of medicine and science and they go strictly with their nutritionist who may or may not be knowledgeable about the science of that, right? There are a lot of people well-meaning, but they're just a nutritionist and they'll take that guidance over the medical advice. And the way I look at it is it's really working as a team, isn't it? And that's what you're doing, right? Aren't you working in concert with medical?
I don't work specifically in concert, but my teaching encourages people to work with their physicians. There's a difference, you know, and we had a dear friend who was diagnosed back in the 90s with a lymphoma. Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is very, very treatable, quite frankly, and was encouraged at the time by a New York hospital to begin treatment. Well, this individual said no, and he went to one of these programs down south and started just taking tons of supplements and pills and other things, and, you know, he succumbed. And when he got to the point where, you know, maybe I better start treatment, they couldn't do it because he looked like a refugee. He was just so malnourished and underweight. So there is a place for science. There is a place for allopathic medicine. There's no look at all the vaccines that we have, who have eradicated smallpox and polio and, you know, other diseases. We have to be thankful for that. But what we're learning beside that too is that we ourselves have some control by what we do, what we choose to do, what we choose to eat, if we choose to exercise, if we choose to deal with stress and emotions in a positive way. So together, you know, it's a symphony. It really is a symphony of working together to keep us healthy and feel good.
You know, this will sound like a little bit funny or odd reference, but I was thinking the other day, you know, I was in the movie theater and they were showing a flashback of a Star Wars movie, and I was thinking of when young Skywalker in that, people will remember, when he got his hand cut off by his father or Darth Vader, and they had all the technology and they put the hand back on, but the bigger part also was he had to be able to work with Yoda and that to get the spiritual part, the part of him who was the other part, to move forward. And I would think that's also part of this resilient thing. It is, you might get the cancer, you might survive it, and after that, you've got another thing to work on. And during it, right, you've got to work on your mind too.
Oh, absolutely. 100%. And in the work that Dr. Kelly Turner has done, and her books are amazing, Radical Remission and Radical Hope, you hear testimonials from individuals who made incredible changes in their life. You know, there was one fellow, if we have time, I read his book all way back in the 80s when my father was diagnosed. His name was Dr. Anthony Satellaro, and he was president of Methodist Hospital in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He was diagnosed at an early age with stage 4 prostate cancer and given 6 months to live. It had metastasized to his bone. And in his book, he tells the story that he was driving back home from his father's funeral on the Jersey Turnpike. And uncharacteristically, he picked up some hitchhikers who he referred to as hippies back then. And he told the hitchhikers his story. And they said to him, you know, you don't have to die. They told him about macrobiotic eating. Long story short, he went back to his work. He found somebody to help him cook. He lived alone. A couple helped make meals for him. He lived about 14 years beyond his diagnosis. And when Dr. Neil Barnard, who was president of Physicians Committee, was down in Florida back in 2020, right before COVID hit, we had a big veg fest. He was a keynote speaker. He starts telling this story about his good friend, Tony Satellaro. And I'm sitting there going, I read that book. And, you know, Dr. Barnard said toward the end, after so many years of being in total remission, he kind of reverted back to his old way of eating. You know, we can't say for sure that's what turned the cancer on again. There could be other factors. But the fact is that he had a diagnosis of 6 to 9 months. Get your affairs in order. And here he lived many years beyond that. So, you know, he wrote that book. It's called Recalled by Life, telling his story. And we know now, science, there's so much linked with prostate cancer, especially dairy. The science is there. You know, we keep men in my classes, give up the dairy. If there's one thing you want to give up, you know, give up that dairy. So dairy is carcinogenic, and a lot of people are shocked to know that.
This is just really great conversation. And just a reminder that the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersections between art and science. And we encourage you to explore further in conversation with others or your family, any of the ideas that we're exploring in today's show, and we'll be right back.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
Welcome back. I'm having a conversation with our guest, Joanne Irwin, about the keys to sustaining a healthy lifestyle, which includes proper food choices that are delicious and engage all our senses in the dining experience. And I kind of wanted to end in that vein back with, you know, we can have as much fun cooking as we did with meats and other things, cooking plant-based. And yes, we can rediscover the love of creating a new dish, of yes, using new things. And I think that's one of the exciting things about this. And I would assume that what you do in your cooking classes is to not just show us the technique, but to get us almost, you're almost like a magician who's casting a little spell on people to go, well, I never thought it could smell like that. I never thought it could taste like that. I never thought. So what do you do in the classes that really help do that? Because I know some of it has to be not just teaching, but going beyond that.
Well, I think a lot of people in the classes are absolutely in awe of how wonderful tofu can taste. You know, they have this image of tofu as just being like, you know, mush and tasteless, but what you can do with tofu is incredible. And the same with tempeh, which are, you know, pressed soybeans, and seitan as well, which is called wheat meat. For people who have, you know, a celiac or gluten sensitivity, seitan is made from vital wheat gluten, so that might be something they can't have. But there's so much you can do. Matter of fact, I'm having some company Thursday night, and I'm making a mushroom Wellington. Instead of a beef Wellington, it's mushrooms and pecan Wellington. Mm. People have it, and they are like, oh, my God, this is so delicious. One of the things I love to make is chocolate mousse. Now, the neighbors down the street, we know they make their chocolate mousse with a lot of cream and a lot of eggs and whatever, and I make mine with tofu, and they are blown away totally. Wow, this tastes so delicious, and it's easy and healthy. So it's fun to share that. And even kale, people are shocked at how wonderful kale can be. And one of the first things I ever made was a kale smoothie. I'll tell you a funny story. My very first class I ever did was at Whole Foods in Naples, January 2009. I start off making a kale smoothie. And just kale with pears and oranges, bananas, whatever, kale, chopped up kale. Well, the next day I went back to Whole Foods to do some of my own shopping, and there was no kale. And the produce guy said, you know, we had a run on kale yesterday. So, you know, again, it's trying these foods, you know, try it, you'll like it.
It is. It's trying them. It's having somebody who's accomplished at making it work there. You know, I said that about kale. However, I love one of the local places has an incredible kale soup. And, you know, it's really perfect in there. And it's a way of adding it. And I've had it added to other things. It's just, you know, the plain. I was I'm head of a school, and we were a private school, elementary school. And we had a couple of parents, really well-meaning, but they would send their children in because they were vegan and have their children come in. But what they sent them in with was so boring that when the kid's looking around and seeing the Twinkie next door and the other, you know, or the meat sandwich, it, you know, it was really hard to push that on them. So my first advice was, you can vegan, you can do that, but let your child kind of decide where they're going to go here to some degree. But the second one is, if you are going to only give them vegan food to go to school with, make sure it's really, really colorful and yummy, and that the other kids are looking at it and want it just as much too. Because yes. Otherwise you got, I watch these kids not eat it. And, you know, the parents think that they're eating it, and they would eat off of everybody else's stuff. So like back in the day when people didn't ban television, right? Some parents, no television, but then they go to somebody else's house and they had never developed the habits of when to turn it off or when not to look at it. Right. So they, for them, they were in the zone. And that's how this little kid was. She was just looking around and, you know, everything hers just looked, it was all brown and yucky. So again, it was a parent trying to do the right thing, but not thinking through that. And that's what you're saying too, that it's more, way more than just what you put in your mouth. It's the way it's combined. It's what you with it, right?
The way it's prepared, and color is so important. If you take a look at, you know, we stress you're eating from the fruits and the veggies, the legumes, the grains, your nuts, your seeds, your berries, and you're putting so much color that's enticing. And the thing is, too, with parents and children, if you start your children as babies, toddlers, and giving them what you're eating, they will embrace this. I have many fellow instructors with children, and their children are totally plant-based and love these foods. And I get such a kick out of watching a young child, 4 and 5 years old, glomming on a salad and chewing that kale and enjoying it. You know, we need to do that. We need to be models for our children. We have to stop asking our children, what do you want? What do you want? I have family members. That's all I hear. What do you want to eat? I'm sorry. This is what we're having, you know. Eat it or make yourself a peanut butter jelly sandwich, you know? So it's a matter of modeling too for our children. Yes.
And it's a matter of experimenting too. And I like that part of it. But that's how we got to have the other recipes we have too. It's a matter of trying different things, but there are different things coming out in the stores. Something I found that I really like, that's a replacement for me for a bun, is the cauliflower flats that Trader Joe's has.
Absolutely, yes.
And they're really, really more tasty. Mm-hmm. And if you heat them up a little bit with whatever you're putting in there, they're incredible. Sprouts still are really, really good if they're fresh. And so there's just all kinds of ways that I can still make a really good lunch sandwich, but I don't have to, you know, I don't have to have all the other things in it.
Absolutely. I mean, there's jackfruit now in the stores. Jackfruit is a wonderful addition in stir fries or sandwiches or tacos. There are soy curls that you can buy online, and they're dried, so you know, rehydrate them, and they are wonderful. And you think you're eating a chicken, basically. But these are healthy choices, healthy alternatives to add to foods, because a lot of the fake meats that are out now, they may taste good, but if you read the label and take a look at what's in them, especially all of the oils, the coconut oil is a tropical oil. It is nothing but saturated fat. It's going to clog your arteries. It's going to ruin your endothelial cells. Watch out. So
yeah, if there's anything that you put it on the shelf or in the fridge and it gels up, you got to be suspicious, right?
Well, it has 20 ingredients.
Yeah, or it has 20 ingredients. I know. It's just, it is a way of wading yourself through that, taking the time to do that. And it is an unfortunate thing, I think, that a lot of food companies have created a way that it's easier to eat badly. And cheaper to eat badly.
Right.
And that's the unfortunate thing, to eat better costs more. And so that gets to be really tricky. And I think you're right that, you know, a part of what we need to do, and it's beginning to happen as more people go to the store and they want something different. That they're driving the stores and the food companies mm-hmm. have to think differently about it. But you do have to be an educated consumer.
You do, absolutely. And the other thing we haven't touched on, but, you know, we have a planet that's groaning. We have a planet that is withering. And if you eat plant-based, if we took out the agri-farming, the meat production, and the, you know, the dairy farms, we would make such an incredible difference in our water usage, in our land usage, in our soil, the reclamation. We are killing the planet. We are killing the planet. And, you know, climate change is real. You know, what are we leaving for my children and grandchildren, my grandchildren's children? Very, very concerning to me. And so that's another reason. When I first went into this, it was basically for health and wellness. But right now, it's also for climate. We need to be stewards of this planet. And we humans are not very good stewards.
Yeah, there's a really great book that I use with my students that I teach urban ecology to. And it was Braiding Sweetgrass. Some of you may know about it. But she's a biologist and also somebody that was indigenous. And one of the two things that she brings out in there that are pertinent to what you said, one is she talked about planting the three sisters, and which is that you plant a corn seed, a bean seed, right, and a squash seed all in the same hill, which would have been the more traditional native way of doing it rather than monolithic planting.
Yeah.
So what happens is the legume, when it comes up, right, shades the soil and keeps any kind of weeds from growing. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it can take the nutrients, particularly nitrogen. It can fix it for the plant to use. So it puts it back in the soil. The corn plant grows really tall and above all that and protects the plant under it. And then finally, the squash, which is later to come along, goes out all over the place on the ground, and it keeps holds the water underneath because it doesn't dry out from the sun. And I thought that was brilliant.
The second part
of what she said, and that was understanding plants. The second one is that the notion, and that's what you're talking about with our grandchildren or grandchildren's grandchildren, we have to, and all these things about our health, about our planet, we have to get back to thinking of how does this affect the seventh generation.
Yes.
In other words, if I look out seven generations from now, what am I leaving?
Yeah, and absolutely.
If you can think about that distance, and that's what you're saying, it makes a big difference on what we do now. We've got to get over this short-term gain. You know, it's me, but we've got to stop doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. True. Very true.
It's been really a great conversation. I want to thank you so much, Joanne, for engaging with this. I've been talking to Joanne Irwin about food and the environment and healthy lifestyles. Until next time, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again when we explore more curiosities from the intersections of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.